And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. Lynn Ware Peake is off on assignment, as we say. She'll be back next week, of course. Our next guest, Andrian, who in 1980, with her husband Carl Sagan, co-wrote what would become the most iconic science-based television series in history, and its companion, one of the top-selling science books of all time, Cosmos. Now, this book sold more than 40 million copies worldwide, New York Times best-selling list, for over a year, and now 40 years later, Anne is releasing the sequel to the book Cosmos with the new book Cosmos: Possible Worlds, which premiered on National Geographic in March 2020. Now, Cosmos: Possible Worlds is also the name of the series, so and the book. You can go to On Demand and probably find those earlier episodes. It debuted on March 12th, just several weeks ago. Our conversation with Anne was pre-taped 3 weeks ago, and now here is that interview.
John, Lynn, thank you so much for having me.
Anne, we are delighted to have you on the program this morning. And back in 1980, the first Cosmos, it's pretty much responsible for me being a science educator. And then there was the second installment in 2014. Only 135 million people saw that program. You got a Peabody and an Emmy. For any of our listeners not familiar with the first two installments of Cosmos, how would you describe Cosmos: Possible Worlds, which is airing, I believe, March 9th on PBS, and of course the new companion book that we're talking about this morning?
Well, Cosmos is for everyone. It's a distillation of the story of the searchers, the generations of searchers who have in some way contributed to our current understanding of nature and the universe. The first Cosmos that I wrote with Carl and Steve Soder back in the late 70s, broadcast in 1980, was a kind of a way of establishing our coordinates in space and time. And, you know, what was so thrilling about it, and now seen by hundreds of millions of people, was that once you finished watching the series or read the book, you had a comprehensive science literacy. And the dream of Cosmos has always been to empower each and every person so that they can be informed decision makers, but also so that they can experience that glorious spiritual uplift that comes from knowing even the little we know about nature and the universe. And so I think of us as a story-driven species, and what every season of Cosmos does is find many never-before-told stories that are doorways into the complex ideas so that all of us can understand them. I'm not a scientist. I'm just a hunter-gatherer of stories. So I know if I understand what I'm writing, then everyone else will. And that's the secret of Cosmos. It's not afraid of the wonder and the joy of knowing these stories. And yet the science is rigorous because we vet every book and script, among dozens of distinguished scientists to make sure that I haven't gone horribly astray.
And one of my major takeaways was that science is important. The scientific process is not perfect, but boy, it certainly works. And I really appreciate in this new installment, it's really a call to action that our distant descendants will not have a future unless we really take a look and at what our responsibility is here and try to get the facts straight.
Absolutely. To me, the challenge is for us to start taking what science is telling us to heart, not compartmentalizing science as a collection of amazing facts that, you know, maybe are 40 minutes a few days a week of boredom or terror, but instead to see science as a way of seeing absolutely everything and a way of thinking not just about science, but about all the things in our lives. And so, yes, you know, the scientists have demonstrated their awesome powers of prophecy. The problems that we are only just beginning to seeing vast quantities of carbon dioxide, methane, other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere would do to our world. We knew that long ago. But it was, you know, that was, we seem to have been sleepwalking throughout this period and are only now just really awakening to how urgent the challenges we face are. That said, Cosmos, both book and series, are suffused with hope. And I base that hope on my contention that if you're alive now and you can hear my voice, you are descended from countless generations of people who had their backs to the wall and managed to endure hardships that we can't even really imagine countless times. That's who we come from. We can do this. We can rise to this challenge if we use our science with wisdom and forethought.
What a great message of hope and inspiration that you bring to us, Anne. And I want to, I guess going back to the first Cosmos that you co-wrote with your late husband, Carl Sagan and Peter Soter, I remember feeling some amount of intimidation by that book. Maybe it was my age at the time. Maybe I was too young. But what I'm learning with your sequel, with Cosmos Possible Worlds, is that there is no factor of intimidation here. You, in this book, and what you did in the previous book that I didn't know until now, was that you're really tearing down those walls of scientific intimidation. And you start your book off in the prologue talking about Albert Einstein and his 700 words opening the 1939 World's Fair in New York City. And wow, can you take us back to that time and how it has inspired and been your mantra over 40 years of science writing?
I'd love to, Lynn. Thank you so much for all your kind words. I really deeply appreciate them. So in 1939, the Depression was still going on. Carl's parents were working class people who really had a marginal kind of subsistence existence. And in 1939, with the worst global bloodletting in history, the Second World War, just a few months away, a summer away, New York held a World's Fair that was about what? The future. Mm-hmm. Imagine, you know, if they had known what the future really held for them, how horrified and terrified they would be. But here was a dream of the future. And Carl Sagan, 5 years old, is taken to the World's Fair by his parents. They're so poor. They bring a brown bag lunch. They can't afford any of the food at the fair. And they can't get any of the wonderful souvenirs and tchotchkes at the fair that Carl lusts after. But at that moment, his life trajectory is set, because for the first time he realizes that there's such a thing as the future and that science is the only way to get to it. So we, in the series, we are able to bring to life the fair. And in surfing around YouTube one night, I found a clip of Albert Einstein's opening of the World's Fair. He was supposed to explain cosmic rays, which was a phenomena that wasn't really understood until during the time I was writing this new book. And so he didn't think he could do it in 700 words, but he finally agreed to. He was talking to 200,000 people on a rainy night in Queens. There were many, many more listening to it on their radios across the country and maybe around the world. And Einstein began his remarks this way. He said, "If science is ever to fully fulfill its mission the way that art already has, its inner meaning must penetrate to the consciousness of the people." Well, when I saw that on YouTube, I almost cried, because that was always all of us would understand and feel the revelation of science about the grandeur of life in the universe, the complexity of life here, the beauty of it. So I took that, as you said, as my mantra throughout the series and the book, because, you know, we are at a moment of low human self-esteem. Mm. And I think we need a vision of the future. All of our movies and popular culture are a reflection of our current reality, and all they show us is a dystopian view of what the future will be. We'll all be living in shipping containers. Everything will be dirty. No trees. Hell. And so I was inspired by the fact that there are so many ways to mitigate the effects of climate change and even to actually diminish the amount of greenhouse gases that we're putting into the atmosphere to preserve the magnificent biodiversity of Earth and to repair the environments that we've destroyed. And I had this vision of how we could do this based on the work of huge number of scientists. And I wanted to share this vision because, you know, dreams are maps. And without a great dream of the future, how can we inspire the next generation to do the hard work required to know something deeply, to become a scientist or an engineer or a technician or a mathematician or a great science teacher? All of these things require so much hard work. And Cosmos Possible Worlds is not only my vision of the exoplanets that circle other suns that we might one day visit, but also this beautiful planet, this possible world.
Possible worlds. You have a big job here, Anne, in communicating that, as do all of the science communicators that John and I regularly speak to, whether they're from Discover Magazine or Scientific American, or they're writing these incredible books that bring the layperson into the folds of science. It's such an important job, and I just wanted to thank you for doing this and bringing this sequel to us. It's fantastic. Could you talk about the illustrations in the book? They are wonderful.
Well, thank you. And I have the great people at National Geographic Publishing under the leadership of Lisa Thomas to thank for many of these images. Many of them come from our show. And, you know, I just, there are so many ways of imagining what might be. I felt it was really important to have many illustrations just to bring to life the, you know, the possibilities of the future, but also some of the ancient artifacts. For instance, the Possible Worlds title not only refers, as I said, to those exoplanets and other worlds, but also to the lost worlds of this one. In the show and in the book, we bring to life the proto-city, one of the first cities called Şatalhöyük on the Anatolian plain in what is now Turkey. 9,000 years ago, our ancestors built this magnificent apartment complex. It was before the street had been invented or the door. And so these people who were in the pioneering generation of settled agriculture created this completely egalitarian city in which, you know, we've studied the bones of men, women, and children at Şatalhöyük, and they all had the same level of nutrition. I'm sure there were problems. I'm sure there was violence. I'm sure they did terrible things too, just like we do. But they carried with them from our much longer hunter-gatherer history the ethos of sharing. And so I thought it was really inspiring to just to take the world on a visit to Şatalhöyük one night during its flourishing, just to see how many different ways there are to live.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Anne Drian, about Cosmos, Possible Worlds. It starts on National Geo, the program.
Anybody there?
Yeah, are you there? Can you hear us, Ann?
Yes.
Okay. The program begins on March 9th, and the companion book is Cosmos, Possible Worlds. Lynn and I only have 100 questions, but we only have Ann for another minute or two. But get the book and make sure you start watching the program on March 9th. Ann, I have to tell you that I thought I knew everything about Mercury, Gemini, and the Apollo program, but you had something in your book was just fascinating, a gentleman by the name of Kondratyuk, who went to jail and ended up sending this letter 50 years before we even landed someone on the moon on how to land on the moon. Can you, we only have you for another couple of minutes, but can you tell us about that?
Yes. Oh, what a man Yuri Kondratyuk was. Really extraordinary. Terrible life, a life of relentless persecution. And yet sitting in a trench in World War I, you know, as a soldier, he had a vision of a practical way to get to the moon, which turned out to be the exact route that the Apollo program took. And he wrote this letter to the future, self-published, never received any credit for what he did, really, only more punishment. But he was the first person to understand the gravitational assist, that the gravity of a world could be used as a way to slingshot a spacecraft to other worlds. And he dreamed that we would swing from world to world as our ancestors once were swinging from tree to tree. And he also understood, as the original Apollo program did not understand, that the way to get to the moon was to launch a spacecraft to the moon, put it in lunar orbit, have an orbiter manned by one person while two other astronaut cosmonauts would take a lunar lander to the surface of the moon, which could then blast off from the moon and return to the orbiter to return home. Now, the original Apollo project, they were trying to do something called direct approach, which was to take a giant rocket, land it on the moon, very difficult, then have it take off once again from the moon, and then land on the Earth. Very daunting, probably impractical challenge. And it was only when the Apollo engineers received the self-published manuscript, which European scientists had preserved, of Yuri Kondratyuk, as one version of the story goes, the one that I believe, that they understood that how to accomplish the Apollo project. And the reason I believe this story, which is so touching, is that even though Kondratyuk was utterly forgotten and no one gave him credit for what he had done, after Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, after he came home, he made a pilgrimage to Yuri Kondratyuk's miserable house in the Ukraine to pay his respects and to thank the long-dead Kondratyuk for his brilliance in planting the foundation, giving the foundation for the Apollo program. So for me to be able to give Kondratyuk his due and some of the other never-before-told stories in the book is so meaningful to me because it was these searchers, some of whom were willing to sacrifice their lives just to say that it matters what's true, to stand up for science. Is a great inspiration to me, and it's why I do my work.
That is one of many incredible stories in this book, and I'm sure also in the program, which will be on National Geographic starting and PBS on the 9th of March. And we want to thank you. And we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
John, Lynn, thank you so much for having me. It was my great pleasure.
Okay, thank you.